very welcome along to this special edition of the Why Big Football Show. I'm Dave O'Grady. The show has been knocking around for the past 3 years since I set it up when Ireland engaged on their qualification for the Euros campaign under Giovanni Trapattoni. A lot has changed since that, but the show has gone on and on to interview fans, players, pundits and media people that all support the boys in green. On this special edition, I'm going to look back at some of the great interviews that we had with such big name stars. So first and foremost, I want to look back at the John Delaney interview that we had right before Christmas, when there was excitement in the air for the introduction of Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane as Ireland's new management team. Well, it's been a roller coaster year for the boys in green, a new management team in place, and things will get very interesting in 2014. Well, we're delighted to have FAI Chief Executive John Delaney joining us once again on the Why Big Football Show. John, we recently seen Everton boys James McCarthy and Seamus Coleman pulling a Christmas cracker and revealing a very nice Christmas present that the FAI were promoting at the start of the month, a Republic of Ireland jersey and a ticket to the Serbia game, Ireland's first match in 2014. I think it was 50 for adults, 40 for kids. I think the offer is finished now, but a very successful offer, no doubt.
Well, so I think it's obviously important in the difficult times we live in that that we recognise that supporters are finding things difficult, and the team hasn't been as successful, obviously, over the last campaign as anybody would have wanted. There is a new bounce with the new management team in place. There's no doubt about it. With Martin and Roy involved. There's a real enthusiasm about the Irish team. But I think it's important to come into Christmas that we did a special offer. I think it's great value. You get an Irish jersey and a Serbia game for 50 quid, as you said, if you're an adult, and 40 if you're a child. And yeah, there's been a very good response to that too as well. There's no doubt about that. But it's the right thing to do, and it's important that we recognise that times are tougher, and that the team hadn't achieved getting to Brazil, which was the objective, of course, at this time last year.
Indeed, John. And, for the Serbia match, it'll be the first squad that will be picked by Martin O'Neill. So no doubt fans will get a real feel for the type of players O'Neill has got in his plans. And that's got to bring a lot of people into the Aviva Stadium in March.
It is. I think there's been a real positive vibe since we announced Martin and Roy. There's no doubt about that. And we saw that for the Latvia game. I think there must have been 20-odd thousand extra people at that game than would have been there had we not made their appointment, if I put it to you that way. They played very well in the night. We did well in Poland. He used 22, I think, of the 23 players. And you're right, like when he names his squad in February, I think that'll be done in Limerick, actually. We're going to do that in Limerick because it's the city of sport and culture for 2014, and we'd like to recognise that. So I think Martin will do that in Limerick probably in February or so. And I think for everywhere I go at the moment, there's certainly a positivity that certainly wasn't there. Obviously, the night we were beaten by Austria in Vienna.
Yeah, certainly. And just to go back to the jerseys, I know a lot of fans have been talking about the new black away strip, which we've seen the boys in green wear from time to time. It's become a bit of a novelty, I think, to Irish fans. Are we the only country that has worn a black strip? I know England, I think, wore a dark navy strip for a while, but are we making a little bit of history there?
I don't know that, but I'll tell you, it's better than the orange one we wore out in Macedonia by a long distance, trust me.
You'd be surprised, John, the amount of fans actually looking to get their hands on that orange one. I think there's one of the fans that collects all the shirts, and the orange one is one of the ones he keeps getting asked about.
Is there maybe to burn it, maybe to burn it, but it didn't bring as much love. But I think certain people like certain colours. I mean, I love the green. The green is our colour, it's our country's colour. The black here, funny enough, a lot of supporters like it. It's very good for leisure wear, I'm told, and things like that. But ultimately, whether they wear black, orange or green, it's getting good results is what it's about, isn't it? That encourages everybody, gets people in good form, gets people optimistic, gets people supporting the national team. And I really do hope, of course, we're another Christmas away, or Christmas a bit away from Paris in 2006 or France in 2016. But please God, in the next time I'm talking to you at a Christmas show, we're talking with great expectation about going to France in 2016.
Indeed. Well, it seems like every year, the past few years anyway, John, has been a roller coaster for Irish football. And looking back really on 2013, as you said, the disappointing World Cup campaign, saying goodbye to Giovanni, then the buzz around the dream team of Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane coming in, the appointment, of course, of Rude Doctor as high performance coach, and some good results as well for the under-21s and under-19s squad as well. It's been a real mixed bag, I think.
Well, it is. Well, I suppose football, as in life, is a roller coaster. But certainly, when you take the senior national team, there was and will be a lot of disappointment that we can go to Brazil, because as we get near to the World Cup next summer, and everybody's focusing in on this huge tournament, and we're not there. I mean, that'll hurt. That'll hurt me. It'll hurt supporters. It'll hurt everybody. I think, as you said, the appointment of lads gave a big bounce. Then Martin and Roy coming in. Rude Doctor is a huge role in Irish football. You know, an underage development plan, which is high up the priority for the board of the FAI. He's coming into us in January with a review of the Emerging Talent Programme. We're putting some of the representative bodies already put their names forward for a technical committee, which will be coaches. And I think the coaches in this country should have a big say on player pathway. And that's very much, I think, one of our biggest objectives in the next 12 months within Irish football, is getting a complete national development plan, getting a technical committee with coaches involved in determining the player pathway. We've over 33,000 coaches in our coaching ladder, so we need their experience to tell us what's best for the players. So Rude's appointment, as you quite rightly said, was a very important one. But look, any day in Irish football, there's ups and downs, but I think towards the back end of this year, there's been more ups and downs, but certainly not qualifying for the World Cup was a big blow and will be a big disappointment when the World Cup takes place and we're not present.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I don't think the Brazil is much colour as it does have. It won't be as colourful as if the Irish were there. On the domestic scene, John, St Patrick's Athletic winning the Airtricity League and Sligo Rovers winning the Cup in another cracking final. It's great to see Irish football being so competitive these days from a domestic level.
Well, it is. I mean, St. Pat's, won the league, deserved to win the league. Liam Buckley's a good manager. He's got some very good players. Made some good acquisitions, bringing players like Killian Brennan in. He did really, really well for them. So, I mean, they'll be in the Champions League, obviously, next year. That's a big one for Liam and St. Pat's. And I know their owner, Gareth Kelleher, has stood by that club in a very strong way to make sure that it has the stability so that, you know, people like Liam Buckley can get on with their jobs. It is very competitive in the Premier League. There's no doubt about it. Who would have said that Shamrock Rovers wouldn't get into Europe for 2 years in a row after their tremendous performance the year before that? Sligo have a hell of a side. They won the Cup in dramatic Cup final, fantastic Cup final against Drogheda. Both teams deserve huge credit. And it's great to be playing those matches at the Aviva Stadium, for sure. And then you've only got to look at the Cork are coming. You know, we've got one team in Galway back in the First Division next season. We'll bring its own merits and its own strengths. And you can never discount Shamrock Rovers. You can never discount them. They're a big brand name in Irish football, as we all know. And, tremendous results, as I said, a couple of years ago in Europe. Haven't had the same results in the league, but they won a couple of cups this season as well. So, all in all, I think it's a very competitive league now. And from a geography point of view, it's getting better too, because Derry and Sligo, Cork, obviously, and, you know, the one team in Galway, Limerick back in the Premier Division, as well as Athlone Town. So there's a better spread of teams outside of Dublin, which is important for any national league.
And your own team, Waterford United, I think finishing fourth in Division 1, but no doubt you'll be hoping to see them make a big push next season.
Yeah, I'm hoping every year. Obviously, my dad was chairman of the club in 1980 when they won the FAI Senior Cup. They only won the Cup twice, 1937 and 1980. They had a great tradition of winning leagues in the 60s and 70s. And they just can't seem to get out of the First Division. You know, they got to the playoff last year, beaten by Dundalk. Haven't got a 2-all draw up in Oriel Park, a beat at home. Next player, Michael Rafter, who used to be a Waterford, scoring a couple of goals, I think.
Yeah.
And this year they just fell a little bit short. They just fell a little bit short, but it was a strong division. You know, obviously, Athlone did really, really well, and Longford got to the playoffs after beating Merview. I think on the last day was the Waterford lost down in Cove, and at the beaten Cove, they got to the playoffs, but they didn't. And it's going to be a very difficult division in the coming season, because Shelburne have gone down there. Shelburne will want to get straight back up. This new entity in Galway will be strong. Longford got to the playoffs for 2 years in a row in the First Division. They got to the playoffs. They got Waterford. So So, I mean, it's not an easy division to get out of.
And as you mentioned there, Galway, the new entity, I suppose, bringing back a lot of the old fans, and it's great to see soccer is going to start thriving in the West again in Galway City. I know Sligo have had the full mantle for the past few years. And Athlone Town, great to see such diverse football. Athlone being back at the top table, really kind of the centre of Ireland, and no doubt a real soccer town. They'll be delighted to have soccer back there and being at the top table of Irish soccer.
Well, they will in Athlone because they have a great history, you know, with Michael O'Connor, the O'Connor brothers. You know, they have a great history. They won a couple of leagues back in the 70s and 80s or whatever it was. I think Trapattoni's first time in Ireland was playing Athlone, wasn't it, when he was fit?
Yeah.
I think was it Inter Milan, I think.
AC Milan,
in 75 or something. That was his first time. He was looking for what he called the tribune, and there was no tribune just on the side of the field. But they are a good club. I know people like Paddy McCall, who's our president for the years, put a huge effort in there. And it's good. It's great to see them back. From the Galway point of view, I put a lot of work into that, along with many, many other people, to, you know, encourage Salthill and Merivale to step out to Connacht Senior League and to form with gust the supporters, which is always very important. The supporters are on board, along with the Galway League, who own them at DC Park. And then we got the Comer brothers involved in a very good sponsorship deal to give them a good start for 3 years. I think they're getting, you know, a sizable sum of money. So that's a project, I mean, I'm thrilled about. We went down, we launched there a couple of weeks ago. It was a great launch. There was a great feeling around the room that all these different parties have come together for the one objective, to make senior football in Galway great again. And, you know, they've got a very good manager in Tommy Dunn. Family's got a great tradition in the game. So I wish them well next season. I wish them well.
Yeah, I've been getting press releases into my email on Galway. They're signing everybody left, right and centre. So it's great to see, and it's certainly a push in the right direction. From an international point of view, John, what would be your main hope for 2014? No doubt a good draw for the Euro qualifiers will be the main thing.
Well, we're a second seed. I mean, sometimes I read in the papers that our FIFA rankings are dropping, but we've moved from a third seed to a second seed, which gives you a little edge. You never know. You never know when a draw is made. You know, you can be lucky and unlucky. That's on the 23rd of February in Nice. I'll be going out with Martin. And, you know, there is such a thing as a lucky and unlucky draw. You can get better groups than others. But whatever we get, we've got to have the confidence in ourselves, that with the management team that we have and the players that we have, that we're as good as anybody on any given day, to try and, you know, get out of the group. The top two go through, the best third place team goes through, and then the eight third teams play for four spots. So when 24 teams are going to qualify, it gives us a great chance. It certainly gives us a better chance. But all those other countries like Armenia are improving as well. We've seen evidence of that, and there, I know it's a cliche, but there are very few easy games in football. But let's look forward to the draw in February, see who we get. We'll know on that day then who we're playing and when we're playing it. There's new rules about that from UEFA, which is good. We don't have to do these fixture meetings anymore. And I think that's something that I've got, you know, obviously, you know, it's the most important thing. The first couple of months will be that draw, because we see who we get and when we're playing them.
Yeah, and from a performance point of view, John, we've been talking about younger players in the squad for quite a while now. But I think it's probably fair to say the time has come to no longer refer to them as younger players. The likes of Seamus Coleman and James McCarthy, they're quite experienced internationals almost at this stage. Mark Wilson and a couple of the others coming through. It'll be a real time over the next 2 years for them to step up to the plate.
Well, it would. And obviously Seamus Coleman and James McCarthy are playing the Premier League with Everton, who are doing very well at the moment. Darren Gibson's with that club as well. You know, please God, he gets back injured or gets back from that injury
absolutely.
Before the end of this coming season. I read talks of Aidan McGeady going to Everton. I mean, it'd be great to have those four players at Everton and playing in the team, you know, because that we keep hearing about some of our players not playing at the highest level. But at the moment, Seamus Coleman and James McCarthy certainly are. And, you know, Robbie Brady's got looks a great prospect for us, you know, once he gets game time. I think we've got a lot to look forward to. I really do. I think we've got a lot to look forward to. And, you know, I genuinely believe that Martin and Roy, in their respective roles, we'll get the best out of our players.
Now, Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, they have said, John, that they're open to exploring all avenues and possibly recruiting new players through the granny rule and eligibility rule and that. Now, I know a lot of Irish fans seem to be quite divided on the issue. Some people will say that we shouldn't have to be trying to beg players to play for Ireland, you know, those that might not get their game for England, whereas others will make the point that we're a small country, we use our unique diaspora to its full potential, and it's necessary in order to get the best players on the pitch. What would be kind of your views on that whole thing?
Well, first and foremost, truthfully, I don't know any time we begged a player to play for us.
Yeah.
Never. A player might have inquired about his availability for to us. We might have said, you know, through a grandmother or a father or a mother, you can play for us, you know, but it's your choice. And that's always been the way with us. And we've never, in my time, brought any player in my opinion, that we said, listen, we got told on our knees that please play for Ireland. That's not the way it should be. I think if you talk to Mick McCarthy, Ray Houghton, people who are second generation Irish, I mean, they're as Irish as anybody. And they believe hugely in that. Andy Townsend was a great captain for us too. You can go back through the years. I my own experience, Shea Brennan, who grew up in our house, he won a European Cup medal at Man United, and he was the first English-born player to play for Ireland. His mum was from Carlow. And Shea considers himself Irish and loved playing for Ireland. He got 23 caps and he was captain of Ireland. So I think sometimes it can be easy to dismiss people because of where they were born. It depends on the attitude they come, and of course, natural ability, of course, as well. But most of the lads I've seen come in, you know, bar none to my mind, have come in with the right attitude. They're professional footballers wanting to play for Ireland, wanting to do well for Ireland.
Yeah, I think a lot of people agree with you there, John. I don't think we have ever seen any Irish player who hasn't really given 100% in the green shirt. You know, it's certainly great to see. Just before I let you go, John, on a completely other matter, are you looking forward to Christmas? Will you be able to relax for a bit? Because I know you're football crazy. Will you be able to spend a bit of time with the family and forget about it? Or is the plans already in motion and you're looking through things for 2014?
I'll tell you, my dad had a bypass on Monday, which went well, thankfully. So that kind of that came out of nowhere. A double bypass went well; it went very well. So he'll be in hospital for a bit. So I think we'll spend a bit of time visiting him. To be honest with you, he's very good to me, very very good to me. And thankfully, last Monday, obviously it's a worry when your dad, his parents, gets a little bit ill. And thankfully, the operation went well. I was there on Sunday. Monday was the operation. Tuesday morning. And we'll be nipping down to see him a bit during Christmas to keep his spirits up. And thank God it went well. And please God he'll make a full recovery.
Yeah, well, please God he will make a full recovery, John, and pass on the wishes from myself and, of course, all Irish fans. You know, we hope everything will go well there. Listen, John, I wish yourself and your family a very good Christmas. And we look forward to kicking the ball rolling in 2014 and join another roller coaster, which is Irish football. Thanks a million.
Thanks, William. My pleasure. Good luck to you now. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Why Big Football Show on Freak FM. Get involved with the show. Email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook. Chat to you soon. That was John Delaney chatting to us before Christmas. Now, about 2 years ago, we also spoke to the man who sent Ireland to the World Cup in the USA 94, Alan McLaughlin, who had also played in Italia 90, wandered into an offside position maybe for Kevin Sheedy's goal against England, but we won't hold him to that. He was very good to have a chat with us, and I asked him quite a bit about his career, which was really remarkable, and the different clubs that he has been involved with. You're listening to the Why Big Football Show, the Irish soccer show by the fans for the fans. If you want to get involved with the show, advertise, or even sponsor, drop us an email to theworldstalking@gmail.com. That's theworldstalking@gmail.com. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter, @theworldstalking, without the G. We'll chat to you soon. Come on, the boys in green. Yes, indeed, you're very welcome to the Why Big Football Show, the Irish soccer show by the fans for the fans. I'm Dave O'Grady, and we're thrilled that our special guest today is the man who sent us to the USA for the 94 World Cup. He also played for Ireland in the Italia 90 World Cup. Alan McLaughlin, thanks a million for joining us.
Not a problem, not a problem whatsoever.
Alan, before we chat about your career, take us back to that November night in Windsor Park in 93. It was quite an atmosphere. I remember watching it on the television myself, but I don't think there were actually even any Republic of Ireland fans up there. It must have been quite surreal for you guys.
Well, actually, there was a few pockets in there. They were pretty quiet, as you'd imagine. They kept themselves to themselves, and I'm pretty sure when I saw the goal, they get there. Probably sat on their hands. But going back to the atmosphere, yeah, I've spoken about it many, many times in all my years in football, from when I started at 16 at Man United through to when I retired at 35. Yeah, it didn't quite sample an atmosphere like that. Obviously, it was troubled times. Obviously, passions were running high. And passions were running high not only off the pitch, but on the pitch, but on the bench. So overall, wasn't a nice atmosphere, something where we were glad to get away from the stadium, glad to get back to Dublin and celebrate, obviously, myself scoring that equaliser, which was vital, which was significant, which was important. So all the things that could have happened and could be encapsulated into one night, that was the night for tension, passion, anxiety, everything rolled into one, really.
And relief as well at the end of the day.
And relief as well, quite right as well, yeah.
You came on actually in the 70th minute, I think it was. Were you given instructions by Jack? Was it kind of just to stick around outside the box and wait for the breaking ball?
Well, this is broadcastable, so I mean, I can't really broadcast what he says, but if you can imagine him asking me to get on and stick the ball in the back of the... Basically, that was the instructions. Get forward, try and get us a goal. And not much more than that. Jack, knew what I was capable of, and Jack also, and I recognise that the lads in and around me, your Roy Keane, your Paul McGrath playing in midfield, the quality we had, your Andy Townsend, Houghtons, it was a waiting game, and I was more than happy to sit in amongst all them great players, be a part of it, and waiting for the opportunity, waiting for one moment that I might make a significant contribution, and that was the night. And I'd come on, and literally Jimmy Quinn had scored. And to be fair to Jimmy Quinn, he scored a wonderful goal on the night. It was a fantastic
finish. Yeah, it was terrific.
Jimmy. And we often, when I see him, we speak about it, but he knows on the night, obviously, my equaliser overshadowed that. But technically for me as well, I think the more pleasing thing for me on the night was I didn't understand the significance of the goal going in until after the game and obviously what it meant. But on a personal level, to get my first goal after hitting the bar two times, the post three times, being unlucky, missing some chances. So the relief in my face when I score is actually... I was delighted to score a bloody goal because it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it was for the goal because everybody, I suppose, thought that relief would have been, yes, I've just sent Ireland through to the USA. But of course, The Spain and Denmark match was on kind of parallel at the same time. So you guys had to wait.
We're not privy to that. I mean, we're out there concentrating. And actually, I was more than delighted and more than happy to be on the pitch because that was the safest place, if I'm honest. So I was happy to be out there. I wasn't happy when Jimmy scored. But then when the ball came in from the free kick, and now Quinn does a really good job. I think it was Big Ian Dowie went to try to come and close me down. And Big Quinn, he just eased him out of the way. And, I practiced and trained to get that ball down quickly from my chest down. It bounced down to my left foot, which I was quite handy with, and I've hit it sweeter than not. And as soon as I struck it, it was always going away from Tommy Wright, the goalkeeper. And I had more than enough pleasure to turn away and as you can hear, my voice, it still now gets me today.
Yeah.
It still ignites that little bit of passion and that feeling. And to be perfectly honest, I was out there and could do it again. But I can't. I'm retired. I'm nearly 45. But I still reminisce and talk that goal through.
Oh, fabulous stuff. And I want to introduce one of our fans making his debut on the show is, of course, Paul. Paul, you're with score.ie and you guys do the electronic scoreboards for loads of sports matches, but you also do live blogs on big games. You probably have a few memories of that famous night at Windsor Park.
Yeah, well, I was only 6 years old at the time, so my memories aren't particularly vivid. But I can just looking back at the tapes and things, over the years, like it's obviously an incredible game. Like the hostility of the ground that the players obviously had to deal with was incredible. And fair play to Alan, the rest lads, for actually showing the character to not be overly intimidated and getting a positive result. It was a great game, incredibly dramatic stuff, and so much so that there was even a play I think based on it years later.
Yeah.
So, fantastic match, right? and obviously epitomised by the great goal from Alan.
Certainly is. And coming to John just on this, you know, anytime Ireland are at a major tournament or qualifying for a major tournament and they show us clips of old highlights of the great years and that, we always see Alan's goal going in at Windsor Park, the one that got us to the USA. And as Alan was saying, you know, the celebrations were kind of, they were muted almost in Belfast, but straight back to Dublin on the plane. And I think we all remember the lads coming off the plane at Dublin that time after having qualified, and, you know, loads of people had gone out to the airport to meet them, and it was great all round, wasn't it?
It's up there, yeah. It's one of those reeling in the years moments, I suppose, where whenever Ireland are getting to a tournament or anything, that's the one people talk about. You know, it's Bonner's save in the quarterfinal in 1990, Houghton's goal, Houghton's two goals, I suppose, and Alan's goal is always up, and probably Robbie Keane in 2002. So, yeah, it was a massive win. I was just about old enough to probably start remembering watching matches himself. And I remember my uncle was actually up at the match in Northern Ireland and saying that he scored and he was delighted inside, but just contain himself, or John, he would have been badly beaten up. But,
John, Paul said he was of age when that goal went in. I hope you don't remember asking. How old were you?
I was 8 or 9, I think.
Oh, 8 or 9. Just a very quick one. When we got back to Dublin Airport and we had a big press conference, there was myself, Andy Townsend, the captain, and Jack Charlton. And Jack Charlton came out with a fantastic quote, which was, "Alan finally justified his existence." So I think that sums up Jack in a nutshell. Takes everything in stride, but I mean, he did. I justified my existence. And I mean, for people who were only 6 and 10 at the time, and for me personally, for them to be able to remember that, well, not remember it, but it, to latch onto it as something significant again is really significant for me.
Incredible.
And
Alan, and you mentioned what Jack said there when you got back to Dublin and did that press conference and that, because you had been involved with the squad for quite some time, and of course playing in the Italian 90 World Cup, I think you came on against England and Egypt, and you know, that was part of that terrific team that we had under Jack. What was it like to play in the World Cup?
Well, for me, it happened very quickly. Jack had been trying to get me into in and around the squad in late 89. I got called up to a couple of games, but unfortunately I couldn't make it because of commitments to Swindon Town, who I was playing with. I eventually played in a B game down at Turner's Cross against England. We played against them and beat them 4-2. I did great, scored a goal in that game. Was invited to another game, but unfortunately couldn't make it. Swindon were doing fantastic well in the playoffs. And literally, I got a phone call prior to the playoff final at Wembley in May 1990 to say I was in the squad. Now, I thought it was a wind-up. One of the young lads was winding up, or one of the older pros. I told Morris Setters to do one in the nicest possible sense. I put the phone down. 5 minutes later, he called me back and said, "If you put the phone down again, Gary Waddock will be remaining with the squad. You are in the squad." So I took it on the chin and moved forward, and I was in for, you know, that great time. I came on against England. If anyone very carefully watches that goal, the Kevin Sheedy brilliant strike, I'm actually about 2 metres offside. I wheeled away with horror. I thought the referee may have set the lines and might have spotted it, but he didn't. Then there was a fairly uneventful game against Egypt where I came on. They put every man behind the ball, and we got through on 3 draws through to the next stage. And then, obviously, I mean, with the squad from Euro 88 through to, you know, you can say probably 98, it was a stronger squad, and particularly 96, is it the most, you know, fantastic run of competitions. The only one that really eluded us, and it was a fairly obvious one, was European Championships.
Yeah.
We were lucky to draw against England. Then we had Yugoslavia in a group who were 3 and 4 in the world. So we had some tough groups, but it was wonderful. And Jack was very plain and simple. You know, what you see is what you got. He kept the tactics simple. He kept the team talks, and more than anything, he kept a wonderful team spirit. And I think that's the key for any team in a tournament. You have to have the right blend. And you didn't mess with Jack, because if you did, whether you're Paul McGrath or Alan McLaughlin, you're all treated the same, and that was key for our success. And as a group, we all got on fantastically well.
And looking back, I suppose, at that Italian 90 World Cup, had you come on and played against Romania or that, would you have felt confident? Would you have taken a penalty?
Well, certainly. if I was asked to, I would be honest, if you'd have probably asked for volunteers, being only 21 or 22, just coming into it. But I was doing incredibly well at that time, scoring lots of goals. So I'd have stood up and took one if I was asked to take one. Whether I'd scored it would have been another thing. But the way Tony Cascarino hit it, it doesn't matter. He half scuffed it, but it went in the back of the net. But I think there's no way you could have said to Jack Charlton, actually, no, I don't want to take it, because I probably wouldn't have been involved again.
Yes. Yeah, I know, absolutely. And just a little bit, Alan, about your club career and that. You know, I think you began as a youth at Manchester United, but leaving United early on, I think it was you were 16. I mean, that must have been hard, because I guess no doubt for yourself growing up, any kid like that would have liked to play for United. But at that stage, did you kind of think you were still going to have a big career in football, let alone 40 caps for your country or that? I mean, it must have been a difficult time.
Well, it was. I mean, I was actually joined United as a 16-year-old as an apprentice, and I left at 19, and there was an option to stay for another year. But then it was all about making your league debut. I realised that Man United had Mike Duxbury ahead of me, had Arthur Alberston ahead of me, John Gidman had just come to the club. There was lots of John Sieverbeck. There was international fullbacks, and I was actually a right-back and a left-back and a defender. And that's where I was predominantly playing for Man United. And I knew the pecking order against me was pretty high. And the new Macari at Swindon, who I played in the reserves with at a very young age, came knocking and offered me the chance to go to Swindon, who were then just about to get promoted from the old fourth division to the third. And I decided to take that route because I was just desperate to play a league game, because, you know, now lads are quite happy to stay in, and the culture is to stay within the squad and you get your chance when you're 19 or 20. It was about getting that league game under your belt to say, I've actually achieved something. Got there, and it snowballed from there. Lou Macari was excellent. We got promotion twice. Ozzy Ardiles was a breath of fresh air to football, played the diamond shape. And I moved forward slowly into an advanced position and scored loads of goals. And, you know, my career took a forward step, which was great. But I had great self-belief. I had a great grounding at home from my mum and dad, who, you know, said, look, you need to take some chances when they come along, and you've got to grasp the ball by the horns and get on with it. And that's what I did. And great career, loved every minute of it. And I'm proud of the fact I was in it from 16 to 35. So I'm still now in the senior academy coach at Portsmouth, just trying to develop young players and make sure they have the same opportunities as I had.
Yeah, it certainly is, Alan. And, you know, it's great to see any player get through those years playing football, with, especially we hear of horror stories where people's career, footballer, young footballers' careers are cut short and that. But for yourself to spend all those years in the game and get through them, it's terrific. Now, I want to come to Joe on a point. And Joe, you've often said it on the programme a few times about the importance for a lot of the Irish players to be playing games. And as Alan was saying, you know, he moved to Swindon and he got his game at Swindon, and then he got to play under Ozzy Ardiles, which was fantastic. But do you think, like, you see it in today's game, I think the majority of footballers, particularly Irish footballers, would rather be playing at a lower team, even, like, it was great in Alan's case that Swindon were on the up, like, at the time, but it's probably important for the Irish players to be playing more so than, you know, sitting on the bench at a bigger club.
That's something I've always believed in, you know, that you see when a player, even when he's out injured or out of favour with a team, you know, when he first comes back in, you know, they're missing that little bit of first touch, that little bit of control that only comes, you know, with game time, with experience. And I mean, you know, playing reserve matches or, you know, training in a gym is all well and good, but at the end of the day, what you really need, and what I've always believed you need, is, you know, is experience, is game time, you know, time on the ball, time, you know, getting ready for the way the game is proceeding, and just being, you know, being, I suppose it's being in a competitive environment. So I mean, there are a lot of players now that I kind of are watching out for, that I think are missing out on that. I mean, I think Conor Clifford at Chelsea is one now that we've all been talking about for a few years, and I think he's only a few months younger than James McCarthy, but James is coming up on, you know, the end of his second full season of Premiership football, whereas Conor has just had a handful of games out on loan in at League One level. You know, and I really do hope that he gets either a run in the Chelsea side, which might be unlikely, or maybe a loan to say someone like Bolton or Wigan, where he'll definitely get, you know, the first team experience that I think he'll need to push on into the senior team, to the senior the Ireland team.
Yeah, and Alan, you know, I guess the importance of playing under a manager that really suits you now. I know maybe when you initially went to Swindon under McCarrie or that, the game, the way they were playing was kind of different to your style of play, but then getting to play under Ozzy Ardiles, what was it like to play under him? He's quite a character.
Well, he certainly is, and, you know, Lou's style of play was to get the players as fit as they could. I wouldn't say it was direct football, fairly similar to Jack's style, really, but yeah. It was what was required to get the club up to the next division. And then once Lou had moved on to West Ham, Ozzy came in, and it was such a massive coup for the club. And for the players, I mean, to me, sat in the same dressing room as Ozzy Ardiles, and actually playing, he played a couple of games for Swindon prior to actually having his boots up and saying, well, I concentrate on management. It was an amazing feeling, such a young player as well, to have him around the place. And he just gave everyone ultimate confidence. Even if you think, I think him personally, if he thought you were a fairly average player, he didn't obviously let anyone know that, but he made you feel like you were the best player in the world. And he did that with everyone. And the way he acted in and around the players, and he was very free spirit, and he wanted the players to play in a certain way. It was a new formation. It was a diamond formation. Everyone then around, obviously through the 70s and the 80s, were playing 4-4-2 into the 90s. And he decided to change that ethos, and it was revolutionary. It was different. We had three front players in Duncan Shearer, Steve White, and myself, who between us scored over 60 goals. And it was fantastic to see, and fantastic to be involved in as well. So it was just a great pleasure. And he moved on to many clubs, obviously on to Spurs. But the one thing about Ozzy, he could get the best out of players. He was a free-tacking, free-spirited person, and sometimes, obviously, that he didn't take care of the other side of the game, which notably at Tottenham was the defending side, because he thought the game was about scoring goals, entertaining people, and making and putting smiles on people's faces. And I think maybe even in the early 90s and the late 90s, that was okay. But it's such a massive industry now, and you know the stakes are so high, the money's ridiculous what clubs can earn, that maybe coaches now take a little bit more time, a little bit more thought, and it's defend first, attack second. If you manage to win the game 1-2-0, well, brilliant.
Would you compare him to, say, managers today? Like, a lot of people would say Martin O'Neill might be something similar in the sense that he can make players feel like they're superstars and really get the best out of them. There's a few managers out there that still have that ability, I think.
Well, there certainly is. I think Martin, I've never worked with Martin, you know, I've never been around, so I'm just hearing exactly what you're hearing. I think probably Harry Redknapp would probably be the actual closest person, you know, seems to have a good affinity with the players. The players en masse seem to say they love playing for Harry and playing in and around his sides. They can be pretty ruthless at times. You have to have that ruthless edge. And Ozzy had it as well. If he didn't think you were quite good enough, you know, he wouldn't, you know, berate you. He would just move you out the door slowly and, you know, explain it in a nice way. And there's very few people probably who actually dislike the man. So, and that's unusual as well. But such a nice guy, lots of success in his short time, lots of football clubs. But I don't think he compromises free-flowing style, set up a side just to go out and defend first. So, you know, different styles, different characters, you know, and that's what it's a bit, that's what football's about. It's about a different mix of characters. It's about different opinions, different social aspects as well. And people's take on the game is different from one pub to the next, from one bar, from one office, whatever. Everyone's got an idea and a way of making it happen, and I just agreed and liked the way he did, and he got the best out of me.
Certainly is, and that'll probably go down for yourself as one of the greatest memories for you, Alan, in club games. And I mean, you scored a lot of goals that season, I think, including a winning goal in the playoff final in Wembley Stadium against Sunderland. Now, I think Swindon had been demoted or that, but they were brought back up or that kind of thing that year. And of course, there's other memories, like for yourself at Portsmouth, you became the club captain, and no doubt you know you're working there today as the academy coach. Like, you're keeping a close eye on things, but it is a bit of a difficult season this year.
Well, it certainly is, and I mean, the club was mismanaged from the time they were in the Premier League to about 6 months ago, and it's total mismanagement behind the scenes at a level where things. When you're in the Premier League for 5 years, there's no way the club should find themselves in the position they're in now. Lots of issues. I'm not going to bore people with it. Football League have a responsibility, owners and the due diligence that's required for new owner to take over. It's all failed the football club, and the football club is the fans. And that's what people must understand, and people coming into a club. I'm hoping and praying that the club will move forward. I'm pretty sure and confident it will. And that's why I'm sticking around the place to try and help out with the academy. We've got some great young players there. We've got a great coaching staff. We just need the opportunity for someone to come in and put some foundations into the football club and think long-term rather than just thinking short-term. And that really, I suggested the same for all the clubs around the country, because apart from the top five or six, the rest will be struggling financially, and you have to have a sound base. You have to look at the future and your future development of your kids. And if you don't, you're really going to struggle, because what we don't want to happen is a European league in 10 years' time where all the big boys go off and play each other around Europe, and we're left scratching our heels elsewhere trying to be competitive, and it's just not going to happen. So lots of responsibilities. I love what I do. I love the Portsmouth Football Club, but I just hope whoever takes over next season will be a football person and have the club and the interests of the club and the fans at heart.
Certainly. And Paul, just coming to yourself on this, I mean, you guys do live updates from games and that, but I mean, if you were to look at Portsmouth, it is a little bit disappointing to see them in the position that they are, and, you know, situations off the field as well as on the field. I mean, they've been a club that we've seen a lot of great Irish players in and out, and, you know, they are a club, as Alan was saying, the fans are absolutely unbelievable, and it'd be great to see them come back if somebody was to come in and really restore the foundations.
Yeah, that's right. Like, obviously, I think the mistake they made was going for the short-term success and spending millions and millions. And obviously, they got it with the FA Cup success, but it's terrible to see what's happened there, and very sad to see them down in the lower in the championship. But hopefully, like, I'm hoping myself that they will get back, because I remember just the atmosphere in Fratton Park at home games when they were successful was just incredible. They're a joy to watch, and as Alan was saying, Harry Redknapp plays that kind of Ozzy Ardiles-esque style of football, very kind of attacking and very entertaining to watch. And I remember him playing that with Portsmouth, and they were just a joy to watch at that time. So, and you could tell they're a real kind of football club. Like, the fans are just are brilliant, and there's always a great atmosphere in Fratton Park. So, like, I think, like most football fans, I'm hoping that they'll be back in the top division as soon as possible.
Hopefully, and we wish Alan, yourself, and all Portsmouth the very best for the future. Just a quick one, Alan. Ireland at the Euros, no doubt you're going to be keeping a very close eye on how we do. How do you think it's going to shape up for the Irish? I mean, will the underdog tag help us?
Obviously, it'll help everyone. We are underdogs. We go in as underdogs. And I think more than anything, as 1990 proved, when you go there and you're relaxed and you go to enjoy the tournament, to take in, be a part of the festival, which it will be, and more than anything, that will be a magnificent and significant boost for the players, because, you know, after a long, hard season, they don't want the extra expectancy. And I think more than anything, they're very conscious of the fact that the fans in Ireland are realistic football fans. They're not your England fans who expect that they're going to go into every tournament and win it.
Yeah.
And they go there, and what will be, K-Sara, they'll do everything. They'll make every excuse up in the world when you've lost. They won't spend time really slagging a team off, It has changed a little bit. It's become more of a premiership, especially to put this, more of a premiership thought process, because now you're saturated with TV and facts and figures and stats, whereas years ago, 95, them stats weren't there, and people just went, watched, saw, and gave an honest opinion based on their own thoughts. Now it's based on what he says and that stat and that stat. So you get a little bit more, we'll say, grievance towards the players and the staff. But they'll go there, they'll enjoy the tournament, they know that the fans at home will be expecting, and but, you know, the group they're in, Croatia, Spain, and Italy, it couldn't be any harder.
No.
So, you know, let's go there. If we get through to the next phase, I think we should all get down and have a dance, because at the end of the day, if we do get through, I'll be very, very surprised. So let's get there, just enjoy the tournament as it is. Italy, Spain, and just if we can get something out of the games, well, thumbs up. If we don't, well, there we go. That's football. We move on. And at least we got there. We broke the duck after such a long, long time to get to Euro Championships.
Yeah, well, our fan John, anytime we have a special guest, Alan, John goes on the YBIG forum, the Irish Soccer Fans Forum, and he collects questions, sensible questions for our special guest. John, you have a couple of ones there.
Yeah, I have a few questions that I put up on the forum here. Some of them have probably been covered already. Like this question there, just about, you know, was it much of a shock for you to get the call up to Italia 90, which you've kind of explained that it was, as you thought it was a wind-up. A good few people talking about that goal, of course. A lot of people just wanted to thank you for it and wonder when the last time you bought yourself a pint in an Irish pub. I suppose it would one of the first questions about that hasn't been covered was, what did you think at the time during the World Cup 94 itself, that you didn't really get a huge amount of game time? And no. Do you think that was unfair? Do you think that was unfair, you know, from Jack Charlton,
really,
given that you had scored the goal to get us there and you were kind of coming into the team at Portsmouth as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'd hoped to obviously get a run, but again, being realistic and being honest, I wasn't going to get into the first 11 with the quality we had. So I was quite happy and content with that. The difference between 1990 and 94 was, in 1990, only 5 substitutes were actually nominated. So Jack had to pick 5 substitutes and 5 or 6 players were left out. So you had a 1 in 5 chance of getting on, depending on the circumstances. In 1994, everyone on the bench, everyone in the squad was on the bench. So when Jack turned around and looked for a solution, or thought, you know, he's got a 10, 11, or maybe 4 or 5 options. So that for him was different. And it was horses for courses. I'm pretty sure in the opening stages, if we were looking to chase a game and get a goal, I'm pretty sure I was in his thought process. The game, you know, I thought I might have got on there at some point, but that wasn't to be. And that was a choice that, again, Jack had to make through a lot of choices. So I'm disappointed because I wanted to have, you know, that cap which said 1 appearance, 2 appearances in 1994, as I've got for 1990. But it didn't happen. Like any player, I was disappointed, but I wasn't disappointed to the fact that I was going to throw my toys out of the cart and demand I'd never turn up again for whatever bizarre reason. So I knew, and I think more than anything, we were more realistic and professional in our approach. Not like some of the players now, who maybe would sooner go on holiday over the championship period and possibly be involved and go there knowing they're just going to be on the bench.
Yeah, I think people are a lot more appreciative maybe now as players these days. I mean, they don't seem as enthusiastic to play in general. But in France, there was a lot of good players in that team in 94 as well. So,
I was never going to get in front of Roy Keane. I was never going to get in front of Paul McGrath, who played in midfield at times in there. So, you know, Andy Townsend, the captain, you know, there's some wonderful players. And
yeah, no, just on that, who do you think the best player was that you played in an Irish year side, would you say, out of all them?
I'd have to say all-round player, the player that made me go, wow, more than most, and even when I was playing with him, was Paul McGrath. I think the role and the versatility of Paul was exceptional, whether he played as a centre-half, whether he played as a holding player in midfield, whatever he did it with confidence. He was aggressive, but he was a fair player. And then obviously the next player thereafter is Roy Keane, without doubt an exceptional talent, an exceptional leader on the football pitch. He got players to go the extra mile, and he led by example. And you know, that was a great pleasure to play with Roy in there. And then there was the emergence of a young Robbie Keane. I remember the first training session that he partook in with the squad. It was, again, one of those situations where you go, bloody hell, who's that? I didn't know he was that good. So, you know, Shea Given as well, Damien Duff, who's still playing, Kevin Caban for his nightmare debut at Iceland. We played Iceland away, and Kevin didn't have the best of, you know debuts, and Jack took him off at half-time. But to go on and be consistent in his career and be versatile and be fit, and, you know, so there's lots of great players. Ronnie Whelan. Oh, what a player Ronnie Whelan was. The best one-touch player I've ever seen. I had the pleasure of training with. You know, for me to be involved with these guys, Dennis Irwin, you know, the best left-back that's probably ever been. Most consistent, steady left-backs. John Aldridge, a complete poacher. You know, brilliant character in the dressing room. So the list could go on. I could go on and on and on. But, you know, them players are significant and stand out along the way. And it was a pleasure to be in there. And again, I can't stress it enough. It was a pleasure to turn up week in, month out.
Yeah, and Alan, you mentioned there, you just mentioned, you know, Paul McGrath and Roy Keane, and particularly during the 94 World Cup. I remember hearing that during the Mexico game in the 94 World Cup, Roy Keane came in at half time, and all the players are, you know, they were playing in that 100 degrees temperatures, which was never any fair to be going against the Mexican side in those conditions. But Roy Keane was reluctant almost to take in water.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a single mindedness of Roy, you know. If he, you know, if he doesn't want to partake in someone, I think one thing with Roy is if you ask him to do something, he's got to be 100% sure himself that he's convinced he's going to work. And even we all knew it was 100 degrees in the middle of the pitch, but he felt he could cope. He was physically very fit, physically very strong, and he was happy enough with it. And that was a single mindedness of Roy. I might have grabbed the water when told. Take some water on board, yeah. On board, you know, have that water, it'll make you better, it'll make you run faster. He was like, well, actually, no, I'm okay, I'm fine, I don't need you to tell me that. If I want it, I'll have it. And I think that just, you know, that was just typical of Roy. He didn't follow the pack, he was his own man, had his own thought process, and it worked brilliantly for him. And again, maybe he thought by standing there and maybe not having the water, maybe he was showing a sign of leadership and hopefully telling others, you know, don't be weak, get on with it. Medically, probably, not advisable, yeah. Because even I was thirsty sitting on the bench, so God knows what those boys are going through. But it was a difficult day. But that just proves, and that just shows, within football or any sporting arena, there's always different characters who are there to make people sit up and wonder why. And there's other lads who can't cope with it, and others do. And it's just an eclectic mix of people who just want to get together, but some are stronger than others. And I think he was definitely a leader, and that proved him exactly why I've said he's up there with the likes of Paul McGrath in two players that I would, you know, say were fantastic players for Ireland.
Absolutely. And Joe, if you're still with us there, Joe, you have a question for Alan.
Alan, I was just wondering, yourself and Jason McAteer and Ray Houghton have probably scored, you know, some of the most famous goals in Irish soccer history. So I was just wondering, who do you think gets asked the most about them? You know, is it yourself for the goal against the North, or is it Ray for his goals against Italy or England, or is it Jason for the famous winner against Holland?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, Dave O'Leary, you could put in there as well with a penalty.
Yeah.
Jason's goal, obviously a significant goal against Holland. I don't really know. I mean, I generally only get asked about the goal, if I'm honest, on the media side of things when it comes around to the anniversary of the goal. I think if there's any significant moments where, you know, times are difficult and they're looking for a bit of spirit, well, then they probably come my way. But as for, you know, it's really difficult because I think it's horses for courses. I think when anyone sees Jason Dominguez that goal, everyone sees me Dominguez
yeah.
that goal.
Yeah.
I'm coming over to Ireland in June. Hopefully, I might sneak a pint or two off somebody who might like who's old enough to remember me. So yeah, I mean it's difficult. I mean I'd like to think myself.
We look out for you, Alan.
I'd like to think myself. But again, I think if you're scoring at the World Cup, maybe a significant goal there. There was obviously Packy save, which wasn't a goal, but was a significant moment. You know, it depends. If it's a qualifier, I'll generally, you know, be asked a question. If it's in the World Cup, it'll be probably Ray Houghton scoring that goal against, you know, the goals against the Euros, against England and against Italy. So it's horses for courses. It just depends on the time and the moment and where people are. In the media, where people are socially as well with it.
Certainly, Alan, and hopefully we'll have a lot more of those moments now after the Euros. We have one more question there from John.
Yeah, one final question. Well, it's kind of two questions. Just who was your Irish roommate when you're away on trips? And as well as that, what's the funniest story you can tell of from being away, room with Ireland?
Oh, well, one man springs to mind straight away, and he was my very first room partner in Malta, and that was Bernie Slaven. I room with Bernie Slaven, I room with Steve Staunton now and again, Eddie McGoldrick. They were probably the three that were most significant, really, along the way. Tommy Coyne now and again. It depends on who was injured. But in the main, I'd say for 3 years, it was Eddie McGoldrick. But my first partner was Bernie Slaven, and my very first encounter with Bernie was
when I after the playoff final at Wembley with Swindon, I flew out the next day to Malta and was met at the airport by Jack Kelly, who was an FAI official. He took me back to the hotel. I made my way up to the room, very nervous when I got there. And Jack said, "You're actually rooming with Bernie Slaven, Alan." I'd never met Bernie before in my life. And, you know, okay, fair enough. And he was at Middlesbrough scoring lots of goals.
Yeah.
And the door was slightly ajar when we both got to the door. And I kid you not, when I got to the door, I heard this wailing. I'm not going to do the sounds, but it was, I thought there's a dog in the room because someone was barking in the room. And I thought, well, that's a bit strange. I didn't know they allowed dogs in hotels. And as I opened the door myself and Jack, and we looked in, the phone, chatting to his dogs back at home, which meant every night around 6 o'clock, Bernie spoke to his wife very briefly, asked how she was, and then spent 10 minutes speaking to his dogs. Ended up with a succession of howls and barks and, yes, can you hear this? The dogs are excited, etc., etc. He got me in trouble now and again, Bernie as well. We queued up in Ireland in Rome, and he made me queue up with him to get a crucifix cross, which we have to be back to the bus for 3 o'clock for Jack. So he's actually been to see the Pope, and me and Bernie arrived half an hour late, and Jack, as you can imagine, wasn't best pleased. But certainly Bernie was the most outrageous. He didn't touch a drop of drink in his life, but you wouldn't have guessed it with his antics. But yeah, he was fantastic, a great roommate, but he certainly kept you on your toes. But I've not had many roommates who've flown home to speak to their dogs.
Yeah, it's incredible stuff. I no doubt you had a bit of an animal time, it's probably fair to say. Before I let you go, Alan, what's the plans for yourself now for the future? Obviously, you're involved, you're the academy coach there at Pompey and that, and hopefully things really work out and Portsmouth can lift themselves back up the table. Is management something you see for yourself now further down the line?
I think I probably missed the boat on management, if I'm honest. I think once you retire from football, unless you get in straight away, I retired at 35 on my 35th birthday, and I'd been doing a lot of travelling back up to Wigan then, and I'd gone home, and an opportunity didn't arise. It didn't arise anywhere. Again, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know,
yeah.
As we all know that. But I got into, and I love my academy work, I love dealing with you know, the academy side of things and developing players. And I want to continue with that and develop that skill and move on in the academy world, because I don't know if you're aware, in England there's new rules and categorisation. So we're hoping to take the club forward eventually when things go well. I wouldn't rule out management, but at the moment I'm very, very happy with what I'm doing. And I also work a little bit for various radio stations here in England, and I do some match commentary. And I also work for Talk Radio in Ireland, and when I can on a Sunday do the match commentary with them. So I'm very busy, but I do enjoy the commentary work, and I spent 6 years following Portsmouth home and away as the radio pundit on there, and took the show myself, and took the course from the fans, and didn't actually do the main match commentary, but co-commentated on games. So I really enjoy that. I really love that. Any opportunities, I'd like to get involved in that as well a little bit further down the line. And that's something I always keep the door open on, that, because I think it's important and I enjoy doing it, and I think I talk sense sometimes, which is always nice, and I'm not afraid to, you know, give my opinion and be sensible in your opinion. I'm not just going to give an opinion just for the sensationalism of it and to cause a stir. It's just on what I see visually, how the team can improve, what the manager can do, what players are thinking. So I'd like to keep involved with the radio side of things, and more than anything, just to develop Portsmouth as an academy, and if it doesn't happen there, continuing academy football, and maybe one day take an opportunity. But like I said, I think I've probably missed the boat on that then.
Well, listen, Alan McLaughlin, Irish legend, Swindon legend, Portsmouth legend, we wish you the very best of luck in the future, and thanks a million for joining the Irish fans on the Why Big Football show today, and we look forward to chatting to you at some stage in the future.
Not a problem, really appreciate it. Thank you, Joe, Paul and John. Not a problem.
That was a great chat we had there about 2 years ago with Alan McLaughlin. Terrific stuff altogether. I'm afraid we're out of time here on the Why Big Football Show. Remember, if you want to contact me, you can email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. Or you can check me out on Twitter. It's @theworldstalking without the G at the end. Thanks a million for joining us on this special edition of the Why Big Football Show. We'll be back next week at the same time for the best up-to-date action, chat and analysis on all things relating to Irish soccer. For myself, Dave O'Grady, have a very good week.